Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Nobody gets into maintenance for the paperwork, but somewhere along the way, the clipboards piled up and the spreadsheets multiplied. Good technicians spend hours per day on admin instead of turning a wrench. MaintainX was built to give that time back. Preventative maintenance runs on a real schedule, automated, assigned, and nothing slipping through. With MaintainX, work orders go out in seconds, and everyone from the floor to the front office knows what's due and when. So your team gets back to the machines, not the paperwork. Over 14,000 companies are already running on MaintainX because the people who keep the world running deserve tools that actually work. Try MaintainX free at MaintainX.com. That's MaintainX.com, an Autodesk company.
You want a career that pays? How about $40 to $75 an hour in total compensation, including healthcare, retirement, and getting paid while learning? That's what the Union Building Trades offer. St. Louis is booming with projects, and contractors need the next generation of skilled workers right now. Skip the dead-end jobs. Skip the mountain of student debt. Learn a trade. Earn a paycheck. Build something that matters. Visit mouniongcareers.com and start building your future today.
This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit villageofbedfordpark.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Thursday afternoon, August 20th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. The Noon Business Hour is sponsored by FinishingChicago.com. We'll look at the changing employment landscape and the new rules for job hoppers in our next segment. But first, it's parts one of Technology Thursday. Opposition to massive AI data centers is spreading across communities nationwide, and with the midterm elections approaching, it's becoming a bipartisan political issue. We welcome in Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, economic futurist at andrewbush.com. Andy, thanks for joining us today. And the polling on AI data center opposition has changed rapidly in the last year. This showed up as a potent political issue in the gubernatorial election and the House of Delegates elections in Virginia last year. And now it's a very potent issue nationwide as the midterms approach. And what are some of the issues driving the opposition?
The major issue is inflation, to be honest. It's affordability in the sense that low to middle income consumers are feeling a heck of a squeeze when it comes to their incomes, whether it's food, gasoline, electricity bills. This is all food for their thoughts and thinking, we've got to stop this somehow. And data centers are the latest villain in this story. And I think it's fascinating to see, really, they're contributing to the overall increase in electricity prices, but so are regulations on coal-fired plants to reduce those. So you're getting a supply reduction. You're getting the demand increase by these data centers for sure, but also manufacturing. You know, we want manufacturing to come back to the United States. That's also drawing on electricity in these different cities like Phoenix or, you know, places in Ohio where you're building data centers, where you're building fabrication plants for chips. So it's really more than just the data centers, but that's how the lens of affordability and inflation is really influencing the conversation on this.
Now, at the same time, you need this. Clearly, there is a demand for AI. People are using it. Is this a problem that could be solved if the tech companies develop their own infrastructure, closed-loop water cooling systems, their own electrical infrastructure to take them out of the grid to provide some rate relief for electricity payers?
Yeah, I mean, that's all part of the solution. It's really a regional strain versus grid modernization, because one of the things that these AI companies do is they pay for upgrades to the grid. That's something that we as a nation have chosen not to do, and we need to do a lot more of that. NARC, which is the North American Reliability Corp, and they look at the United States, Canada, and Mexico, they say we need 200 gigawatts of new power by 2030. Just to put that in perspective, that's 200 San Franciscos of power that we need. So again, there's just this huge demand. These AI companies can do a lot by paying for things, and they do, not only for the grid upgrade, but they also pay a lot of taxes into these communities. So they're right now the boogeyman out there, and they're really, it's causing some problems and bottlenecks for the development of AI overall.
And then what can, very quickly, are there certain things in the PR front that tech companies can do that can make these data centers more palatable in terms of funding local infrastructure, being a part of civic institutions, which usually has moved the needle in the past?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, we're hearing stories about Russia and China also being in social media advocating against data centers in the United States. So there's that. Then you have to offset that by showing, like, hey, we're putting millions and millions of dollars into these communities via taxes that are increasing the you know, the livability of these communities, especially in the rural areas, which had not been getting much money either from the federal government or from economic activity. So there's definitely some things they can do on the PR front as it is, but just telling the truth about what's going on, I think it's really helpful.
Thank you very much. Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
For years, conventional career wisdom suggested that changing employers every few years was one of the fastest ways to increase your salary. That can still be true, but the equation has changed. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Michelle Reisdorf, Chicago jobs expert with the Robert Half Company. Michelle, thank you for joining us today. How has the math changed for those job hoppers?
Well, thank you, Rob. You know, salary still weighs in as one of the key factors that, you know, people will look at job changes. But there's so many other things. The job market really has changed the last couple of years. And people now look at growth opportunities, flexibility being key with hybrid and remote. And the opportunities for new skills or even career advancement equally weigh as much as salary today.
And then when we're talking about just being a job hopper, does that show up as a red flag, especially now in this hiring environment? And if it is, how can you massage that issue during the interview?
Yeah, you know, companies still definitely look at tenure and, you know, longevity at a company as important, but they're more likely to really truly try to understand the full story behind why someone has chosen to move. You know, gone are the days that, you know, you and I grew up in. I mean, I've been at Robert Half almost 30 years. You know, gone are the days where, you know, that is looked at as, you know, a prize any longer. Companies are looking at what skills do you bring to the table? Why did you make those changes? Do they make sense? Or are there some red flag patterns in there that we should be concerned about? You know, with the demand for skilled talent being very high still, employers have to open their mind to the reasons why somebody might have job hopped.
And then as a job hopper, and if your goal is to increase your salary, what are some things that you should really think about above and beyond the number that is in the final offer?
Yeah, I think you still have to look at every job change as what is the long-term prospects that are there. you know, more than just money, do I have opportunities to advance my career? Will I be able to take on more responsibility? Will the company help me learn new skills? So you want to make sure, you know, again, that you don't get tagged as a job hopper because you make decisions quickly and those decisions turn out poorly and you end up having to leave a job. And so still look at that 5-year to 10-year range of what that company offers you behind just salary.
And then also, if you're a job hopper and you really just get that 2-year itch, what can you do to make sure that your next career move is not merely arbitrary and you just have the desire to move, that it actually is an intentional and purposeful move?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rob. You know, you're going to have to be able to explain that to a future employer if it's a 2-year. And so really thinking about that move and making sure that there is a good reason, justification, career advancement for that move so that, you know, for some reason, should that move only last 2 years, you can explain that to the next employer and still look like a very critical key candidate to be hired in the job market today.
And then, of course, if you're a job hopper, chances are you're pretty experienced at leaving a job. But how can you do so in a strategic fashion?
Be always, always be professional and give that full 2 weeks notice or sometimes longer in some situations if a company, you know, might find themselves in a difficult situation with your exit. And so be very professional. You know, with job hopping being so much more common today, you never know where you might bump into that manager again in the future. And you certainly don't want to burn any bridges that you might end up working for again, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line.
Michelle Reisdorf, Chicago jobs expert with the Robert Half Company in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, retailers are betting on physical stores once again as they become increasingly important to their overall strategy.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
After years of predictions that e-commerce would kill brick and mortar retail, physical stores remain strategically important. Joining us to explain is RJ Hadavi, head of analytical research at Placer AI. RJ, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And what are your numbers telling you about traffic at brick and mortar retail stores?
Yeah, I think that what our data shows is that brick and mortar stores, physical retail, is more important than ever. Certainly, we've heard the predictions that, you know, e-commerce would make it a challenge for physical stores, but I think nothing could be further from the truth. And in fact, one of the things we see with our data is actually mall visits have been outpacing, you know, just general retail visits. And so what that suggests is that people are interacting differently with malls and I think overall retailers than they did before. Maybe they're an extension of the company's e-commerce efforts. Maybe they are an attraction, an event. Maybe there's something else. But while people are interacting differently with retailers, there's really important. It's extremely important for a lot of consumers these days.
And you bring up a very important point, is that physical locations are now part of an e-commerce strategy. It's no longer either or. And did analysts predict that several years ago?
Yeah, I think there was some prediction that at least as we started to see e-commerce develop, one of the things that became apparent is that you really can't have physical stores without online and vice versa. A lot of the online retailers have started to move into physical stores. And I think that just kind of shows that it really is important to kind of have that omni-channel approach. And a lot of times that store becomes an extension of the brand. They kind of show what kind of products might be there. They help to really define the brand for consumers. So I think that the idea that physical stores are going away couldn't be further from the truth. And honestly, we continue to see a lot of categories, particularly those in more frequent visit categories, things like fitness and more experiential type retail, continue to do very well in this environment.
It also seems like the brick and mortar retail stores that exist today, they're lean and mean, relatively speaking, compared to the grand department stores of yesteryear. It has a smaller footprint, but each square foot has a purpose.
Yeah, I think you're right, particularly in more discretionary retail categories like apparel and beauty and things like that. Certainly the last few years, we've seen a shrinking of the store base, smaller footprint and, you know, a lot leaner operations. And frankly, it's a lot cheaper to operate something in that size. And on the other hand, too, you do have some more, like food retail, which we do start to see some expansion of retail store footprints as well. And, you know, things like, Dick's Sporting Goods House of Sport concept. You know, we do see some categories where it is larger, but it usually is a way to, you know, build better engagement with those consumers and kind of showcase everything they can do. But in the more discretionary categories, I think we've certainly seen a shrinking of the store box the last couple of years.
RJ Hadavi, head of analytical research at Placer AI, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, from medicine to manufacturing, the surprising evolution of 3D printing.
Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Nobody gets into maintenance for the paperwork, but somewhere along the way, the clipboards piled up and the spreadsheets multiplied. Good technicians spend hours per day on admin instead of turning a wrench. MaintainX was built to give that time back. Preventative maintenance runs on a real schedule, automated, assigned, and nothing slipping through. With MaintainX, work orders go out in seconds, and everyone from the floor to the front office knows what's due and when. So your team gets back to the machines, not the paperwork. Over 14,000 companies are already running on MaintainX because the people who keep the world running deserve tools that actually work. Try MaintainX free at MaintainX.com. That's MaintainX.com, an Autodesk company.
What if your next move wasn't another job, but a career? The St. Louis Building and Construction Trades are looking for the next generation to build what's next. Earn while you learn through a union apprenticeship. No massive student loan debt, just real training, real skills, and real opportunities. Many union trades earn $40 to $75 an hour in total compensation, including health care and retirement. With major construction projects happening across St. Louis and Missouri, there's never been a better time to get started. Build your future. Visit mounioncareers.com today.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. The Noon Business Hour continues. Markets are sharply lower. Joining us with the latest on today's sell-off on Wall Street is Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager, MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, thank you for joining us today. The main indices, the Dow and the NASDAQ, down close to 1%. And how much of this is driven by the bond market?
I think a fair amount, Rob. Yesterday, the markets rallied. Treasury yields came down in response to Treasury Secretary Bessent's comment that they were going to be buying they were doubling the amount of buying that they have done, basically from $14 billion over a year to $28 billion. In effect, though, Rob, all they're doing is lowering the maturity of the Treasury holdings of bonds, because they're selling those longer dated 10, 20, and 30-year bonds, and they're going to be reissuing shorter-term debt. So net-net, it really was a nothing burger, and I think the bond market realized that, which is why yields are up today, and the market is following the move in the Treasury bond market.
And then what are some of the pressure points in the bond market right now? And today, it's as good a time as any to talk about government debt topping $40 trillion, which really everybody in Washington going back many decades owns that one. That's not really it's really a bipartisan issue and bipartisan blame.
Yes, absolutely. If you go back, like presidents, other than President Clinton, every president has contributed to the debt getting to the $40 trillion mark that we see. That is an issue, Rob. Higher Treasury yields are an issue. But the other two things are, globally, yields are going higher. So, yeah, our 30-year hit the highest since 2007. Japan, I think, hit the highest in 30 years. Germany, highest since 2011. So what's happening here is reflective of what's happening around the world. And the other issue is the amount of supply isn't just from governments. It's also the AI build-out. You know, for a couple of years, the build-out was funded by cash flows of the hyperscalers. Well, now more and more, they're issuing more debt. So you just have an awful lot of debt coming into the bond market, not just in the U.S., but globally. And you know, the buyers are demanding higher yields. That's what's going on.
Now, coming out of the Great Recession 15 years ago, Treasury yields were low, and they were low for a long time. And this is we're getting into this. This is where Jim, as the macro strategist, you can take us to school. And there was a bit of a safety premium in Treasuries coming out of the Great Recession because it was reliable. And even though it paid a lower yield, it was a safe investment. And it seems like the math on that has changed.
Totally has changed, Rob. As you might recall, right after the pandemic, you had the financial crisis as being one impulse. The pandemic being the second one, there was $18 trillion globally where yields were below zero. You know, they're really concentrated in Europe. So again, it goes back to the global unwind of what happened since the 2008 financial crisis and the pandemic. And so it's a sea change, basically, is what we're experiencing. I expect it to last for years.
And even though this could potentially last for years, what if anything can be done to bring about a resolution or maybe just a little bit of relief along the way?
That's a great question. I think if the 10-year gets above 5%, which has been my expectation for more than a year, that will set the table for a fairly good rally in bond prices and drop in yields, because it will start to have an impact on the economy. The problem is, if we go into a recession, Rob, the deficit will go from $2 trillion, which is where it's been for the last 3 years, to probably $3.5 trillion. So normally a recession would help because the Fed would cut rates. But in this environment, the surge of supply will shortcut any rally that does in fact happen. So the only thing that can really do it is fiscal responsibility and the bond market's belief that it can be achieved. And given the dynamics in Washington, no one thinks that's likely to happen anytime soon.
Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager, MacroTides.com in San Diego. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, 3D printing has left the hype cycle, but it never really disappeared. We'll explain.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's Technology Thursday, Part 2, sponsored by Nicor Gas. Once hyped as technology that would revolutionize everything, 3D printing quietly evolved into an important tool across numerous industries. Let's bring in Matt Wren, tech expert and founder of VRAR Chicago. Matt, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And it's not necessarily a story of 3D printing going away. It's just merely a story of evolution. 3D printing went from hype to a mature technology.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Rob. That's exactly what happened. It's not an innovation technology so much anymore as it is just a technology that's being used in all sorts of industries, primarily for prototype manufacturing. So things that are small runs of objects that need to be manufactured across all sorts of different industries, everything from, just basic manufacturing to aviation to construction, you name it. It's across every industry at this point.
And it's not necessarily an exotic technology anymore, because if you have kids in grade school, chances are their STEM classroom has a 3D printer. My middle daughter, she received a 3D printer as a Christmas present a couple of years ago, and she and I have had a ton of fun with it, printing out various models and toys. She makes 3D printed things to give to friends for their birthday. So it's very much a technology that's now in your house and not in science fiction.
Yes, it's definitely widely available. I will say, though, there's definitely there's also a lot of innovation. Like it's not that innovation in 3D printing has stopped. There are different types. So the one that you have in your home, it's probably what's called an FDM printer. It has that spool of like plastic molded shapes. But then there's the laser polymer printers using liquid polymers or polymers to print a little bit more, complex shapes or things that would be more used in like an industrial setting. And then there's the 3D metal printing, which is happening so that, a manufacturer can prototype a part that might be like going in an automobile before they actually determine like what's going to go out for actual mass manufacturing. They can prototype variations to say, okay, well, what works best?
And on that subject, a friend of mine is a contractor, and he has the same 3D printer that we have, with the spool and the plastic filament, and he does use it to manufacture components around the house, instead of running off to the hardware store, if he needs a small little piece of plastic to go in some other larger assembly, he turns to the 3D printer.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very useful for people who are manufacturing parts. That's actually one of the things that the military is using it for widely, is that they're actually deploying 3D printers for places where it might be harder to have like a supply chain in place for things where, again, they would need some replacement parts. They can just 3D print them on site. So, yeah, it's a very useful technology for that. I actually have a friend who's a bathroom fixtures or a kitchen like faucet fixture designer. And what they're doing now is they're actually, anything that she designs, they're printing them to determine, like, well, which design is actually going to look best once they have it. And then, again, the ones that they choose will then go to mass production and not actually be something that you'll see in a catalog in the future or in, a store.
Thinking back to Technology Thursday segments from the past, Matt, we were talking about using 3D printing to build a house. There was just a large, instead of the plastic filament, instead of metal, it was a big cement 3D printer that would build a concrete home. Is that still part of 3D printing's future, or is that an idea that was tested and has since gone by the boards?
I'll say that's actually, it's not so much the future, much like a lot of things. It's currently happening. We don't see it so much in the U.S., mainly because of building codes and some of the scalability of it, but it's definitely something that takes place already. It is a technology that is out there. It's been done. It's being distributed. Places are using it. You're not going to necessarily see it in Chicago or in your local suburb, but in some places that is actually happening now. So that technology did not go away. It's being used currently.
Now, at the same time, though, you can make the case that 3D printing could be the future of manufacturing, but once again, it sounds like manufacturing as we know it today is still cheaper than 3D printing.
Well, it depends on what you're doing with manufacturing. Again, it's always going to be cheaper if you're producing millions and millions of parts to actually have, dies set up or injection molding and actually have the custom machinery built to mass produce. That's always going to be valuable if you need to produce lots and lots of parts. And it's always going to be more efficient to do it that way. However, if you only need to produce a small run, 100 units, 200 units, something like that, in those cases, that's primarily where 3D printing has now taken over, and it is being used in industry today all over the place. You just in Chicago, if you want to see it, you go over to MHub or MXD. They definitely have examples. It's in production. It's very current technology.
Matt Wren, tech expert and founder, VRAR Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, a crypto revival is taking hold as digital currencies wake up.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
A crypto comeback is brewing. After months of slumber, digital currencies are waking up, with Bitcoin and Ethereum showing renewed momentum. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park Business Line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Bill Uliveri, owner of Senecal Capital Management in Glenview. Bill, thank you for joining us today. I'll start calling you Uliveri, like Madonna. The brand is that strong, Bill. Thank you for joining us today on the program.
You're welcome.
And what is driving this crypto comeback?
But my nickname was Uliv in high school, so you can just go with that. So what's driving the crypto comeback is, there's an old saying that the government never really controls their spending until the bond market bites back. And so what we saw was yields on the 30-year U.S. Treasuries hit their highest level since 2007, just 2 days ago on Tuesday. And it was threatening to make, home buying and businesses and, potentially derail what economic progress we've made recently. So what's been happening is that there's concerns over this $40 trillion debt that was recently hit. There's worry about the unwinding of the Japanese yen carry trade, which means the Japanese markets would have to sell U.S. treasuries to raise cash in order to buy and support the Japanese yen. There's concerns that the hyperscalers, these big technology firms, have already raised about $300 billion in the market to build these data centers, and Goldman Sachs expects another $400 billion in 2027. So there seems to be a lot of pressure on the bond market. And when people sell bonds, it means that interest rates have to rally. And Bitcoin was the recipient of that, the happy recipient, where it rallied about $10,000 per token from 62,000 to just a hair over 72,000 as we speak right now, because there's fears of Federal Reserve intervention and U.S. Treasury, you know, turning on the printing press, et cetera.
If your knowledge of Bitcoin the last couple of years has been the legal travails of Sam Bankman-Fried or stories of various rug-pulling schemes, and you view cryptocurrency with some skepticism, what is the use case for it?
The use case is that it is, first of all, the use case is that it's a decentralized form of payment. It's a it's like a U.S. dollar, except on internet rails, in a way, right, with no decentralized, no centralized center party risk. So the thing about this is you can think about Bitcoin being this digital gold or digital U.S. dollar, being able to send value anywhere in the world in a matter of seconds for with no bank fee and no credit union fee. But the truth is the Bitcoin technology is what's creating the stablecoins and the Stablecoin Act. And that's where trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars that flow around the globe will be able to map themselves and move instantly rather than a few days or a few weeks at virtually no cost. And if you're outside the United States, I do believe that we're going to hit this two-tier monetary system where there's going to be dollars that are spent inside the United States. And if you are outside the United States and you send money to or send money out to a different country, it will be done on the stablecoin digital rails, and then we're going to collect our tariffs that way. So think of it as a technology that is bringing, that is just recreating everything. Because don't forget, AI data centers are not going to be selling gold, sending gold bullion to each other when you're burning AI tokens. You have to use some kind of cryptocurrency or some kind of token. And that's what it's called in the Claude AI world. You have to burn tokens to use computer processing power. So Bitcoin is just the first layer. Everything that comes after this is going to be, like, amazing.
Bill Ulivieri, owner of Senecal Capital Management in Glenview, thank you for joining us today.
Nerds!
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Nobody gets into maintenance for the paperwork, but somewhere along the way, the clipboards piled up and the spreadsheets multiplied. Good technicians spend hours per day on admin instead of turning a wrench. MaintainX was built to give that time back. Preventative maintenance runs on a real schedule, automated, assigned, and nothing slipping through. With MaintainX, work orders go out in seconds, and everyone from the floor to the front office knows what's due and when. So your team gets back to the machines, not the paperwork. Over 14,000 companies are already running on MaintainX because the people who keep the world running deserve tools that actually work. Try MaintainX free at MaintainX.com. That's MaintainX.com, an Autodesk company.
What if your next move wasn't another job, but a career? The St. Louis Building and Construction Trades are looking for the next generation to build what's next. Earn while you learn through a union apprenticeship. No massive student loan debt, just real training, real skills, and real opportunities. Many union trades earn $40 to $75 an hour in total compensation, including health care and retirement. With major construction projects happening across St. Louis and Missouri, there's never been a better time to get started. Build your future. Visit mouniontcareers.com today.
On Reddit, true crime doesn't come from journalists. It comes from the victims, the witnesses, and sometimes the suspects themselves.
Every Tuesday on Crimes of Reddit, we read these posts out loud.
I'm Sabrina Dianaroga.
And I'm Alexis Linkletter. One of us brings the story, the other goes in blind, reacting in real time, just like you.
New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Crimes of Reddit, available now wherever you get your podcasts.